1991. We're here at Lane Place, and I'm Bob Wormley, a member of the Oral History Committee of the Montgomery County Historical Society. This is one of a series of videotape interviews that we're making on behalf of the Historical Society, celebrating, or I should say, commemorating the 50th anniversary of World War II, the start of World War II. The Montgomery County Historical Society is claiming ownership of the property of these tapes. We plan to place one copy in the local history room of the Crawfordville Public Library. I should say two copies there, and give one copy to the man being, or the person being interviewed. Well, as you all know, this is the 50th anniversary of World War II, and the start of it, and we want to catch the memories of these persons, or these people who were involved in the conflict before they're all gone. This series that we're doing was inspired by that recent Civil War program that was on public television, when it showed the veterans of the Battle of Gettysburg assembling on the 50th anniversary of that battle. So today, I'll start out by asking if you'll give us your name and the day of your birth.
Donald Wingert, November 3rd, 1911.
Don, would you spell your last name, because we'll have
W-I-N-G-E-R-T.
There's a T on the end of it.
Yes.
And where do you live?
At 203 South West Street, Crawfordsville.
All right. And where were you born?
Whitesville, Indiana, Montgomery County.
And would you tell us about who your parents were and what was their background?
John Wingert and Betty Bird Wingert. And they were a typical farm family around 1900. And my grandparents came to Indiana from Virginia. That's on the father's side. And on my mother's side, I don't know where they came from. They came to Indiana early in the 1800s.
And was your early background then, did you grew up on a farm?
Grew up on a farm.
Where did you go to school?
Whitesville Grade School, Crawfordsville High School, and Walnut College, and Ohio State University.
And when did you graduate from Crawfordsville High School?
1929.
And then you went on to Walnut College? How long did you go to Walnut?
I graduated there in 1933.
And you went on to graduate school?
Yeah, I went 2 or 3 years to Ohio State.
What was the nature of your graduate training?
Well, I majored in chemistry, but after I got to graduate school, I decided I didn't like it, so I quit that and went into accounting.
And what were you doing prior to the war? What was your occupation?
Well, I was working here in Crawfordsville at the Crawfordsville Ice Plant, and that was it. When I went into the Army,
Martin's ice company, what was his name?
Billy Martin.
Billy Martin,
that's right.
You were in the class of 29 at Wabash?
No, that's high school.
Oh, high school.
29, that was Leslie Burroughs and young Costanzer. They were in that class of, well, in 29 high school and Wabash College.
Then you were in the class of 33 at Wabash.
Yes.
Who were some of the fellows that were in your class at Wabash, do you remember?
Some of these are dead now. There's Brigging.
Brigging?
Breeding from Warsaw.
Okay.
And Y.B. Hall, he lives in Lafayette now. He used to be from Newmarket. And let's see, there's Tom Hudson. He lives in Crawfordsville now. He was there.
You remember some of your professors there?
Oh, yes.
Who were the outstanding professors?
Well, Dr. Howell, of course, was a chemistry professor. And Dr. Pauly was the math. I had a lot of work under both of those.
Mm-hmm.
I think in 1929, when I first started, that was Dr. Pauly's first year here.
Mm-hmm.
And those were, and Dean Kendall, Dr. Bruce, there were some of the ones I remember.
Mm-hmm. All right, what were you doing, you remember, what were you doing on the day that Pearl Harbor happened?
I think I was probably working. I think I worked on some Sundays, and I think I had my radio with me, portable radio, and I heard about the attack
mm-hmm.
on Pearl Harbor.
And you were working at the ice plant?
Yeah.
And we were working in the accounting department
yeah.
of the ice plant. That was when they used to deliver those big bricks of ice around the city.
Yeah, those are big ones.
All right, where did they get that ice?
They manufactured it.
Where was it?
On John Street.
Oh, okay.
They distilled their water and made the ice in tanks, salt tanks.
Uh-huh. All right, now, did you keep on working there at the ice plant for a while then? And
yeah, see, that was December 41. I didn't go into the Army until June 19th of 1942.
And were you drafted or did you volunteer?
Well, I tried to volunteer and didn't pass a physical exam, and so I was drafted.
And where were you sent?
The basic training was at Keyser Field, Biloxi, Mississippi.
So you were in the Air Corps then?
Yes, in the Air
Corps. What type of training did they put you in?
Well, that was basic training. I guess what everybody gets, marching and some instructions on rifle and stuff like that. Then after basic training, I was sent to radio operator school at Scott Field in Belleville, Illinois.
And let me back up here a little bit. You were pretty well along in years.
Yes, I was 30. I said I was sort of an old man for the Air Force.
Were you married?
No.
All right. Okay, you went to radio school.
Yes.
And you were a private then, I can't take it. And what happened after you went to radio school?
When I finished radio school, I was assigned to the 2nd Troop Carrier Squadron at Hope Field, Fort Bragg, North Carolina. And arrived there on Thanksgiving Day, 1942.
Speak of a troop carrier, was that what you said?
Troop carrier squadron.
What is a troop carrier squadron?
Well, I think the main and the original purpose was dropping paratroopers.
Oh.
And they did a lot of training of that. I don't know that we ever dropped any paratroopers over there, maybe one time or something. But that was what the troop carrier, they call it. And they did that plus cargo carrying, stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. All right. And tell us about what happened after that.
Well, in January 25th of 1943.
Did you stay there until that time?
Yes.
At one place?
Yeah, for that training. And then we got our overseas orders and we left Marson Field at West Palm Beach on January 25th of 1943. Started overseas.
43.
Yes. We had 13 new planes and 13 crews over each.
All right. Now, you were, what part of the crew were you?
I was radio operator.
What else did the crew consist of?
There were 8 men on that plane, and only about 4 of them were the crew. The pilot, co-pilot, navigator, crew chief, and I, that was the crew. And that was like 5 people, and there were 3 others there to help.
What was your rank then?
Private.
Just private.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Tell us your route, where you went.
Well, Puerto Rico, Trinidad, and Belém, South America, that's British Guiana, and down to Natal, Brazil. And that's, we stopped there for a day or two and had auxiliary tanks put in because our planes were small and didn't have
what kind of a plane was it?
C-47.
Okay.
Old C-47.
All right.
For those.
Yeah, sure do. Came home on one of them.
Yeah. And the best plane ever built, I think. And we took overseas to Ascension Island across the Atlantic. Ascension's in the middle of the South Atlantic. So that was the first stop. And I remember it quite well because my pilot got sick. And the rest of the squadron left without us. So he got well and we went solo the next day across the Atlantic. And I was sort of apprehensive, but I was so busy operating, radio operating, that I guess I didn't have time to get
well, the other crew went ahead.
Yeah, the other planes went ahead. My pilot was sick that day, and
So you were solo across the Atlantic.
And of course, in the South Atlantic, you can go to Ascension Island, which is about the middle of it, middle of the Atlantic. And then from the Ascension, you go to Africa, across Africa. We landed, and then from Africa, we went across. We had 2-3 stops because Africa is pretty big. And we ended up at Khartoum, in Sudan. And then from Khartoum, I went to Aden and southern Saudi Arabia now, and on to Karachi, India.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Karachi, we went to Agra, India, up to the upper Assam in India, which is the side of the hump. And then from there, we went to Yangtze, China,
where
that base. It was Yangtze is across the hump, and about 50 miles from Kunming.
Kunming.
Yeah. Kunming is sort of the end of the Burma Road.
Well, you're naming all these fantastic places you've been. Let's go back now and look at your life before you were in the service. Was Ohio State about the farthest you'd ever been from us?
Just about. We didn't travel very much then.
Yeah. So that here you were going around the world, so to speak.
Yes.
Tell us about flying over the hump. What was that like?
Well, it was very rough. Of course, our small plane was going to get too high, and so we had to dodge the peaks. And the weather was bad there all the time. Visibility was bad. You had to fly instruments.
Were you still on C-47? Okay.
And, of course, it was a small plane and couldn't go very high. I think most of the time we flew 12 to 15,000 feet. And our ceiling was about 20,000, I suppose. And of course, you know, the peaks and the Himalayas. Mm-hmm. Are much higher than that, so you had to dodge them. We could see Mount Everest once in a while, but most of the time we couldn't. But flying up, it was very tiring because of the bad weather, and had to be on oxygen quite a time. Of course, that is debilitating. And another thing, the Chinese contracted to feed us. And so they were in charge of the mess hall, and so the food wasn't that good. And of course, I didn't have much to work with. China didn't. And I don't know if they were too sanitary, and like dysentery was a problem with the troops then.
Now, when you went over the hump, was it just a small crew that went, or was it?
Yes, usually it was just the pilot and co-pilot. Once in a while, a navigator and a crew chief would go.
Both the pilot, co-pilot, and radio man.
Radio, yeah.
Okay.
So I got in a lot of fun.
Well, what was your mission there in going across the hump? Was that your regular job going across that hump?
Yeah, I was carrying supplies from India over to China.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
What sort of supplies?
Mainly ammunition and gasoline, but some other supplies, food and stuff like mm-hmm. that. But it's mainly gasoline. Ammunition.
Now, did you come in contact with the Japanese?
Well, it was possible. I don't believe our squadron over the hump had any contact with the Japanese, mainly because there's always so much bad weather you could nip in the clouds and they couldn't see it. And, but I don't remember ever having been in contact when we were flying the hump. It was the weather there that gave you all the problems. It was very dangerous. Our squadron, we flew it from, we got over in February, and we flew it up till July of that year, and we didn't lose a plane.
Mm-hmm.
And I made 51 round trips.
Oh.
So about everybody else that flew was in that neighborhood,
uh-huh.
40 to 60 round
yeah.
trips. I made.
Were you still a private?
Yeah, well, I think I made first class then, or corporate maybe.
Uh-huh. And what about, who was the commander of your outfit?
Well, the one that started out on the way over had a appendicitis or something. He had to go back, and so Major Frank Sears was the first commander over there,
mm-hmm.
squadron commander.
What were the conditions like at the camp on the Chinese end?
Well, if the camp was comfortable enough, it was around 5 feet.
Wasn't a tent?
No, it was buildings, and it was an altitude of about 5,000 feet, and I remember a lot of red clay around, and wind was blowing all the time, too much at that altitude, and I remember going down the company street, a coulee with these yokes on, hanging down. Fresh meat. He was trotting down the street, whole swarms of flies falling. He was going to the mess hall. So that kind of put a damper on my appetite, but they did the best they could, I guess. I know that we were always glad because we flew over the hump to India to get pick up the supplies, and we were always glad to get over there because the food was better
over
the
Indian side. So.
Yeah. And then if the weather was bad and we could get caught on the other side, they would divert us and we'd carry a cargo. So we'd get to Calcutta once in a while, which was a metropolitan city, and stay in a big hotel. And we'd have good food there. And we was always tickled to death to get caught on the other side, so.
Yeah. Now, navigating those Well, that's the home, those mountains. You didn't have radar, did you?
No. The only thing we had was a little bit of radio signals to home in on sometimes. And sometimes they weren't too reliable because of the mountains around. No, the navigation aids were primitive then. No radar.
Well, going over for the first time, how did you navigate? How did they navigate? Did you have a map to follow?
Oh yes, I suppose the pilot and navigators did. And to go so far this way at a certain altitude, and then you had to climb and go a different height. It was we were lucky; we didn't lose any planes over the hump. But other outfits at that time and later lost a lot of planes because of the weather. The weather, and you'd run in the mountains and stuff like that. But our outfit didn't lose any planes over the hump, so we were proud of that.
Was there a land route too across the hump? Or did
we? Well, on the Burma Road, they were working on that. And that time. Yeah, Burma Road, I think, was cut off in Burma, and they started. They built what they called the Lido Road to feed into the Burma Road where it was cut off. The Japanese cut off the Burma Road, I believe. But that was the only land.
Mm-hmm. So they were carrying supplies over the land route at the same time.
Probably, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, when I spoke of your commander, were you under Shaw, or who was the...
Stillwell was that, and Chenault was over there, and I forget who the troop carrier was under General Olds. I forget just who the supreme commander was over there.
Did you ever get to see Stillwell?
No. He was around, but of course he was on the ground most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was leading his troops into Burma.
What about Chenault? Did you ever see him?
No, I never.
What about Olds? Did you see him?
No. I suppose they visited Dinjan, but they didn't visit the enlisted men's mess or anything like that, so we didn't get to see them if they were around. When we moved back to India, we were stationed in Dinjan.
Where were you stationed?
Dinjan, India. That's in Upper Assam.
Oh, okay. You say you were moved back there?
Yes.
Was that the end of your...
That was the end of the hump climb.
What did you do after that?
Well, our food dropping in northern Burma, and we supplied the hilltop weather stations.
Where were the waves?
Well, they were scattered in the interior of Burma, and they were send out weather reports for flyers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we supplied them, and plus...
Would you fly over and drop the supplies?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Kick them out of the airplane. And, this is where we lost so many planes. The weather was bad. You had to fly so low because the food we dropped, our supplies, were parachuted down. Well, you couldn't get them too high or they'd drift off into the jungle and they couldn't find them.
Mm-hmm.
It'd take them days to get them or something like that. So you had to be pretty low to drop your food. And on these hilltops, the weather was so bad, the pilots would lose control of the planes sometimes. And, of course, a lot of times we were close to the Japanese lines and airfields. And several times, they attacked our planes and shot several of them.
Mm-hmm.
December of 1943 and January of 1943, we lost several planes to...
January of 44, you
mean? No, 43. December of 43 and January of 44, you
yeah.
know. They had several planes shot down.
You weren't shot down, were you?
No. No,
Were you shot up?
No, we had some ground fire at us. But, I was lucky. I never happened to be on any of these food driving missions where the, planes attacked us. I was flying a food driving mission someplace one time when the Japanese attacked, six or eight of our planes and shot down three of them. But I was flying someplace else in Burma at that time, and I could hear the battle over the radio, which I was monitoring all the time. I notified the pilots, so we dropped our food as quick as we could and headed for home. But no, I didn't happen to get shot at by enemy aircraft. I was just lucky because I'd been on a food dropping mission. We had a higher escort, but we weren't attacked.
Mm-hmm.
In my, there were 14 radio operators that started overseas, and six of those were killed, and one of them was shot down, parachuted out, and so we had about a casualty rate of about
50%.
He wasn't hurt much, he had a sprained ankle or something like that, but
mm-hmm.
So I assume, I don't never did count up our pilots and co-pilots, and I presume they had about the same casualty rate because it was radio operator and co-pilots.
John, what kind of fellows were these, for instance, your crew? How'd you get along with them?
Oh, fine. I was very proud of my outfit, and the second troop carrier was a very good outfit.
Were you with the same outfit all
the time? All the time I was overseas.
Now, what was the official name of it?
Second Troop Carrier Squad.
Of what Air Force?
10th Air Force.
10th Air Force. All right. What about the other enlisted men? How were they?
I never had any complaint with them because the mechanics did a pretty good job because our planes, we just didn't lose any. Many planes, mechanical failures that I knew of, and other enlisted personnel, I got along with them fine.
Did we? I take it that you came to know fairly well the Chinese were when you were up there in China, but...
We didn't see many, but all we saw was the...
mess personnel?
Mess personnel and house boys.
Uh-huh.
And the house boys, they spoke some English, and we didn't have much contact with the cooks.
Did you have any contact with the army, the Chinese army?
No.
What about when you were back in India, had any contact with the British Army or the Indian Army?
No, they didn't get around the air base much. There weren't any units stationed there, so we never had much contact with the Army. We'd supply them, we drop food to them and stuff like that. When they had a campaign.
You mean the Indian Army or the, or the British Army?
British Army.
Those weather stations, were those mostly British?
They were British, and then eventually there were South Americans.
Mm-hmm. So right now, you're on your food delivery mission. What happened after that?
Well, I eventually sent me home. I've got to say that sometimes they would need some supplies delivered someplace in India, and so we'd pull us off food dropping, and we would deliver those supplies. So I got to travel quite a bit over India. I was at several places, Bombay and Agra, Bangalore, Allahabad, and of course Calcutta many times. One time, rather interesting, we were delivering some anti-personnel mines. And we would deliver them to a base close to Calcutta where the bombers would use them. And so when we got to the airfield, the bomber base, at both ends of the runway, there was a plane had crashed on both ends and burned the bomber. That morning, when they were taking off on a mission, the two planes had crashed. And but by the time we got there, they burned down so we could land. And so they unloaded, and we stayed there that night. And then when I got back to the States, some guy I was talking to at the Legion here, he said I was Indian, I was stationed so-and-so. I said, well, I was there at the time and delivered the personnel bonds. He's when the planes had both ends running, he said, I remember that very well. I helped unload that plane. His name is Foxworthy, and he's in Wayne County. And so, and another time in Calcutta, I was looking at a guest list of a Red Cross unit there and saw Joe Pointer's name. And he'd been there a day or two ahead of me. Yeah. I didn't know him at the time, but of course I didn't know him now. And he had been there at this Red Cross unit
too. What was Joe's job?
I don't know what he was. He was.
And he was over in India.
Yeah, he was in Calcutta. This was Calcutta.
How did you find well, think about how depressing it is in India. Did you find it that way?
Well, yes, kind of. It's not a very nice place to live. It's so hot and dirty.
Lots of beggars?
Lots of beggars. I know you said sometimes. I saw all kinds of dancing a bear and these snake charmers on the street, and saw a man with, you've heard of elephantitis?
Yes.
Your leg looks more like an elephant.
Yes.
Yeah. I saw a man with that on the street. He was begging and so forth. And so you saw all kind of people there. And one of the highlights of the trip overseas was going through the Taj Mahal. It is as beautiful as it's supposed to be. And one time in Agra, we were going to go from Agra to Bombay with some freight, and the pilot said, let's see if we can go at night. It was middle of night. So we could go at night. So when we took off, we could see the top was open, the top of the hall. We could see it in the moonlight. And then all the way to Bombay, there was a cloud cover, and we were above that. And there was a full moon, tropical moon, and that was one of the most beautiful sights that I saw. When we took off, we could see the Taj Mahal, and then the rest of the trip was the moonlight on the white clouds.
Were there ever any periods, do you remember any times when you were afraid you were going to lose your life?
Well, once or twice, on one of the food dropping missions, the weather was very rough, and the pilot momentarily sort of lost control of the plane, and it dipped down, and the wing hit the volleyball and hit the head on the ground. You know how low that would be. And so when we got back, after we dropped the food, he recovered. After he dropped the food, the pilot, co-pilot jumped out, looked at the wing, and it there was some dirt on the tip of the wing, and it scraped the ground. Of course, that would just be about an inch from disaster. And a time or two flying up, we come out of the clouds, and there would be a mountain or something ahead of us, and they would have time to dodge it. So we had some close encounters.
Now, you did get some awards while you were over there. Why don't we get those out?
I got the...
Let's take a look at them and tell us what they are.
The Distinguished Flying Cross with two clusters.
Let's hold it up here so that we can see it. That's the one over here.
Yeah. Right. And then the Chinese government, just 4 or 5 years ago, people that were stationed in China, they issued them a medal that's here and some crew member wings that's there.
Mm-hmm. Was there any particular reason why you were awarded the Flying Cross?
Well, if you have so many combat missions and so mm-hmm. forth over there, you get the... Mm-hmm. the
all right,
the Flying Cross. And then this is the...
You got your flying jacket.
Yeah, this is the jacket that they issued us. And to wear when we were flying so that the, if we were shot down, the Chinese presence would know we were Americans, not Japanese.
This is the jacket that you wore. Did you start out with that?
Yeah,
in the
yeah that's was issued to me in... 1942, January 42. So it's got some age on it. Still pretty good.
Still wear it sometimes?
No. Well, see, it's got these, the cuffs and...
Cuffs are,
yeah,
are worn out,
so... But the leather would be pretty good.
You said that, you just said that the planes are sometimes overloaded. How did that happen?
Well, necessity, I guess. If you want to get as many planes, carry as much as you could.
Who did the loading?
Well, I mean, it was, they had limits, I mean. Be overloaded compared to what we have in the United States now on a passenger plane.
Well, that'd be pretty scary flying around those mountains with an overloaded plane.
Well, yes, a lot of times they'd, in order to gain more altitude, they pitch out some of the cargo so they could get higher.
Yeah. Did you ever carry any troops yourself?
No, not very many. I don't remember, I forget whether we did or not. Of course, carrying troops, we couldn't carry much over the mountain because the you have to go so high you need oxygen, and the C-47s I don't think could furnish oxygen to a whole plane load of people. We had oxygen ourselves, the crew, mm-hmm. but back in the cargo plane, I don't think they had the oxygen.
Did you carry mail too?
Oh, some, yes. We carry it overseas, over into China, so that they can get their mail.
Yeah. Tell us about the weather over there in China and India.
Well, in China, it was, we were at such an altitude that the weather wasn't bad. It was windy and cool, at 5,000 feet. And it wasn't bad in China. But in India, you see, it was close to the equator, and it was hot, steamy. And as I said, certain times of the year, it rained 4 or 5 times a day. And we, of course, we lived in grass huts, and they would leak sometimes.
You think they leak all the time into those grass huts?
Well, the roof was, wasn't too bad, but of course they eventually got soaked and they'd leak some. And of course we had to sleep under skin nets all the time in India, so we wouldn't get malaria.
What about malaria and dysentery?
Well, it's very prevalent over there. Of course, we got a lot of shots. Cholera, typhus, and I don't know what else, tetanus. No, we were always getting shots over there because of the tropical diseases.
And what about the monsoons?
Well, they weren't violent storms, except occasionally.
Would they tear up some of the plains sometimes?
No, hardly ever. They were just a... It was just a sudden shower or something like that. Real hard, and then it stopped. An hour later, another shower. But there weren't many violent storms, except when they had them, they were violent.
All right, when did you come back to the States?
In June of 1944.
That would have been just about the time of D-Day.
Well, probably, yeah. I forget when D-Day was now.
And how long had you been over then?
Well, January of 43 to June of 44, so that's what, 16 months.
And how did you get back to the States?
Came back on an airplane, and essentially it was a C-54 airplane, and essentially it just retraced the route that we had come
over. Just went back the same way you came?
Yeah, essentially.
C-54 was a much larger
plane. Much larger plane, and we didn't have to make so many stops. Mm-hmm. Maybe did it was quicker than we did.
Yeah. Did you come back because you'd acquired enough points?
Yeah, that's right. More or less, enough points.
Were you still a PFC at that time?
No, I think I was a staff sergeant then.
Uh-huh. And where did you go when you came back to the States?
Well, after our R&R in Miami, I was sent to Sedalia Air Base. That's in Missouri. But it was a troop carrier air base sent there.
And what did you, you're still a radio operator?
Yeah, that's all.
And what were your duties there?
Well, they had a lot of airplanes there. Of course, they did a lot of training. So we repaired radios and them. I flew some then. Not as much as did overseas, but flew several times.
When you speak of flying, where did you fly? What
well,
was the occasion for flying?
Well, I know one time we went to Atlanta. They had to take some airplane engines to Cuba. And, when the Battle of the Bulge started. We flew some troops to New York from St. Louis. And then we had to fly some while they were training pilots for the troop carrier. And I fly with them sometimes.
Did you work on the radio most of the time, though?
Yeah, we repaired radios, yeah.
What kind of radios were they? Were they pretty simple?
Yeah, they're kind of simple now compared to what they have now. And it was rather strange. Overseas, the voice reception was extraordinary. I mean, a few hundred miles you could get just talk with voice. Whereas here in the United States, there's so much interference, voice wouldn't carry very far. You have to use CW, continuous wave code.
You were, of course, versed in using the code.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. The Morse code.
And how long did you, were you up to date then?
I stayed the rest of the year. I met the rest of the Army there until the war was over.
When were you discharged?
September 6, 1945.
45. That was about the time of the Japanese.
They surrendered.
Yeah.
War was over.
Uh-huh. Where'd you come then? Where did you go from then? From Sedalia? Back here to Montgomery County?
Yeah, that's by way of, I think maybe Columbus, Indiana, Fort Bend, back here to Indiana.
Were you a tech sergeant at that time, or what was
your... Staff sergeant.
Staff sergeant. Mm-hmm. And you were discharged at Fort Bend?
I think it was, yeah.
Did you, after you got out of the service, did you go back to the ice plant, or what did you do?
No, I started at the balance.
You stayed with families for
the rest of the year. Yeah, I got retired.
What kind of a job did you get done?
I was in the accounting department. And at one time I was budget director and wage and salary administrator. Mm-hmm.
And how long did you work at Dunn's?
I think it was 31 years.
When did you retire?
1974.
Now, you told me about all these grandchildren. You got married there right after the war?
Yes.
Who did you marry?
Evelyn Cox Francis. I married into an Army family. You know, she is a sister of Byron Cox.
Oh, she is. I didn't realize that. The fellow that the post is named after.
Yes. He was the first Montgomery County soldier killed in World War I. And my first cousin, Harold Wingard, was the first Carmelsville boy killed in World War I.
World War I.
Harold Wingard.
Mm-hmm. My wife had a teacher named Miss Wingard in school.
It was probably Aunt Ida.
Aunt Ida.
Over at Mills, probably.
Yeah, that's right. At Mills.
Yeah, she was an aunt.
Mm-hmm. And were these children all yours, or were they your
wife? No, Evelyn had three children, and we were married.
There
are those children of hers.
Yeah, did you
have? I had a son-in-law who became a major general in the Air Force. He was a West Point graduate.
What was his name?
Frank Barnes. He's married to Patricia.
From around the village, was that?
No, he came from Kentucky. But he became a two-star general. And then he had a brain tumor, had an operation and died. So he died fairly young, in his early 50s.
So are any of these grandchildren the offspring of you and that one, or they're all by her phone?
No, they're step.
And how many did you say there were?
20.
20 grandchildren. You continue to work at Donnelly's until your retirement. What have you been doing with your retirement?
Well, I haven't been taking it very easy. I've always been lazy, so I don't, since I've got this back problem, I don't do much of anything because it hurts so much.
Do you hear from any of your old buddies in the service?
A few, not very many. Of course, so many of them got killed, and they got scattered. And I hear from two or three.
Just Christmas time, or?
Well, no. We correspond several times a year.
Does your outfit have any reunions?
Well, no, not really. They have the Hunt Pilots Association. It has a big reunion every year, but I never go to that. They have 1,500 of 2,000 attend. That's just too big. I don't go to that. And our outfit has never had a reunion. I wish they would. I would try to go to it. I don't go to the HPA, the Hunt Pilots Association. They have been every year. But they used to have it in a big place like St. Louis or Denver.
Well, I think maybe we've about covered the territory,
yeah.
Don. I certainly do appreciate you coming out here. And as we said, we're going to see that you get a copy of this tape. And we've been, the American Legion's been helping on financing this, and as well as the veterans of foreign wars, and we certainly do appreciate. Of course, Claire Chamberlain's has conducted a number of these interviews, and Ed Miller has done some of the camera work that this morning, of course, Mike Hall from the Historical Society has been doing it. But we hope that you'll be able to show this to your grandchildren.
Okay.